Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. 103 people have been confirmed dead, 235 wounded in Saturday's Kabul, Afghanistan suicide bomb blast. An eyewitness describes what happened.
I was sitting in my store when the huge blast occurred. I dropped to the ground and then found my brother was hurt. I took him to the hospital. There were already many wounded there, and the doctors were swamped.
The Taliban has claimed responsibility for plotting that attack. Russian police wrestled opposition leader Alexei Navalny into a patrol wagon Sunday, moments after he appeared at a rally to urge voters to boycott what he said would be a rigged presidential election in March.
The moment Russia's opposition leader was detained by police just minutes after appearing at a Moscow rally. Video footage posted on social media shows Alexei Navalny wrestled into the back of a patrol wagon just a few hundred meters from the Kremlin. He was walking to join several hundred supporters taking part in an opposition-led rally. The nationwide protests are calling for a boycott of what Navalny says will be a rigged presidential election in March. Earlier in the day, police raided his Moscow headquarters, forcing their way into the office using power tools, citing reports of a bomb threat.
Reuters' Scarlett Svetanovich. U.S. President Donald Trump touted the continued growth of the U.S. economy Sunday, saying it is better than it has been in many decades. In praising the U.S. economic performance, Mr. Trump also attacked rapper Jay-Z after he criticized Trump in a Saturday news talk show over the president's recent reported vulgar descriptions of people from Haiti and Africa. This is VOA News. Spain's top court has moved to block former Catalan president Carles Puigdemont from taking that office again. The Constitutional Court ruled Saturday that the fugitive ex-president could not rule from abroad if he returned to the presidential post in a regional parliament vote Tuesday. Puigdemont has said he could be sworn in remotely via a video conference session. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy had said that Puigdemont cannot act as a Catalan president while in exile, and that if he is chosen, then the suspension of Catalonia's autonomy will remain in effect. A second group of refugees to be resettled in the United States from Australia's offshore immigration centers has left Papua New Guinea. Washington has agreed to take up to 1,250 migrants held in Australian-run processing camps in the South Pacific.
On Tuesday, 58 refugees flew out of Papua New Guinea. Most have been held at the Australian-run detention camp on Manus Island for more than 4 years. The migrants, mostly from Afghanistan and Pakistan, had been told they'd never be allowed to settle in Australia, part of Canberra's long-running policy to combat human trafficking. Last year, 54 refugees from Australia's two offshore immigration facilities on Manus Island and the tiny Pacific Republic of Nauru were resettled in the US. Another group of 130 refugees on Nauru is expected to leave the island for the US in the coming weeks.
That is Phil Mercer reporting for VOA. Two Republican senators said this Sunday that the U.S. Congress should revisit proposed legislation to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller after President Donald Trump tried to fire him last year while he investigated the Trump campaign's ties with Russia. In separate television interviews, Senators Susan Collins and Lindsey Graham expressed dismay at reports the Republican president had told the top White House lawyer to order U.S. Justice Department officials to fire Mueller. A French woman has been found alive on the treacherous northern Himalayan peak known as Killer Mountain, but rescuers still have not been able to locate her Polish climbing companion. The pair, Tomasz Makowicz from Poland and Elizabeth Revel of France, were attempting to scale the more than 8,000-meter a mountain, but they got stuck at the 7,400-meter mark and radioed for help. Swiss tennis star Roger Federer has defeated Marin Cilic of Croatia to win the 2018 Australian Open in Melbourne. Also in the women's final, second seed Caroline Wozniacki of Denmark beat top-seeded Romanian star Simona Halep in three sets. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
African friends globally to make sure that this particular decision is living life on its own.
The chairperson of the African Union Commission calls for cooperation among nations in combating international challenges.
To have a justice minister designate who is also entangled in some corruption scandal, many Liberians believe it's not a good appointment.
Liberian President George Weah comes under criticisms for appointing a controversial attorney as justice minister.
I'm fully ready. In fact, I have been exercising a lot to make sure that I build up my stamina and my dynamism to face the heavy campaign. So we are set.
And the presidential candidate for the Sierra Leonean Opposition National Ground Coalition says he is ready for official campaigning to begin. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairperson of the African Union Commission, Dr. Moussa Faki Mahamat, has called for cooperation among nations in combating multiple international challenges. His call came at the ongoing African Heads of State and Government Summit in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. The theme of the summit is Winning the Fight Against Corruption, a Sustainable Path to Africa's Transformation. The summit is scheduled to end Monday. For analysis, I reached Sadiq Abba, Professor of Political Science and Development Studies at the University of Abuja.
We Africans, in particular, Africans that are of our own generation, welcome this particular new development, and we hope the African leaders will be able to focus on this particular big and huge priority for Africa. Number one, the African leaders must have that particular result within themselves as leaders. They should be able to at least reach above board. They should be able to at least lead by example, and they should be able to at least cut all the excesses as far as running cost of maintaining African leadership and African centers of power are concerned. The second step is the African leaders should equally mobilize Africans. It's supposed to be a citizen-driven process. It's not just decisions of leaders. It should carry Africans along. Along the path of changing Africa towards a corruption-free African society.
Several decisions are usually made at these meetings. However, implementations have become ineffective. How could this be different, if I may ask you?
Well, this is a big question and a very genuine and genuine concern because historically, African leaders will sit in Addis Ababa and take decisions on their own to implement them. And we hope that this decision should not go down the history lane of just talk without work. How do we make African leaders walk the talk? What are explaining? That it should be citizen-driven process. It shouldn't be left to the leaders alone. Civil society organizations in Africa, institutions in Africa, African friends globally to make sure that this particular decision is living life on its own.
Among the most debated of the reforms that has been proposed at the African Union and is being discussed by these leaders is how to make the African Union pay for itself, because major part of its functions are paid by donors, Europeans, Chinese, and what have you. They are proposing tariffs on air travel and all that. Do you think that is sustainable?
I think these are disparate concerns that need disparate solutions. I believe since the inception of African Union in 1963 to date, I think only 21 Africans living up to their expectations as far as their own payment of due to the Union is concerned. So I believe they should come up with other stringent measures through which African Union should raise their own funding. The era of depending on foreigners, on international organizations to fund aid should be over. So I believe the decision was taken in order to at least start as a solution to raising funds for an African Union. I think it's a welcome idea for Africa. Africa should learn how to pay for their own services. It shouldn't be for Christmas as always.
Issues of conflict on the continent have always been, you know, raised about finding African solutions to African problems. They will be discussing it throughout the two-day summit. Why hasn't Africa been able to come up with solutions to resolving conflict on the continent?
The reality suggests that African continent lacks leadership. And when there is absence of leadership, you don't expect anything meaningful to come up with it. Our inability to solve African crisis has homegrown solutions to African problems as a result of lack of effective, good leadership and good governance system in Africa. So I think not to make the mistake of the past, so Africans will be able to see them to be serious. I think we should be first and foremost put our house in order. Africans should learn how to use democratic process in electing leaders rather than rulers. And when the leaders are in place, then all of us will fall into place. So we should lead us, a leader plus a leader, and another leader for other African countries. We want to speak from the point of view of good governance, democratic process, citizens' rights, rule of law, then all other problems the developing Africa will be tackled at that particular institutional level and institutional approach. I think the fourth thing is keeping African leadership house in order first are some of the ingredients that are lacking. That is the reason why Africa could not solve African crisis within Africa.
Sadiq Abba is a professor of political science and development studies. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Liberian President George Weah is coming under criticisms for the appointment of the Justice Minister over his alleged past criminal behavior. Local media reports that Attorney Charles Gibson, the Justice Minister-designate, was once stripped of his legal license after embezzling a client of $25,000. Meanwhile, women and civil society groups also say the newly installed president has failed to keep his promise of ensuring significant women representation in his cabinet. For more reaction about President Weah's new cabinet, I read Leonard Dodu, the front page African newspaper news desk chief in the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
President Weah began the formation of his cabinet immediately he was sworn into office. He released the first set of cabinet members. Some of them comprised members of former President Selu's cabinet. He retained some of them in office. That didn't go down well with some Liberians. But of major contention is his newly appointed justice minister, who has some integrity crisis. I mean, his law license was suspended for 2 months by the Supreme Court of Liberia because of some economic crimes he committed. So people say that Liberia has been struggling with the issue of corruption, which he, President Weah, had promised to combat when he takes office. But then to have a justice minister designate who is also entangled in some corruption scandal, many Liberians believe it's not a good appointment, and some are calling for the resigning of that appointment.
Charles Gibson, the appointed justice minister in question, you're talking about the alleged embezzling of $25,000 that local media reported. Do you anticipate, with the pressure coming from civil society and other opposition groups and Liberians in general, do you anticipate that the appointment will be rescinded?
Well, we anticipate that, but then we are not confident about that. Immediately he was appointed as justice minister, or when he got the hint that he was about to be appointed as justice minister, he restituted the money, and the Supreme Court last week lifted the suspension of his license. So we believe that the Supreme Court has paved the way for the Liberian Senate to confirm him. And mind you, we have the Senate Committee Chairman on Judiciary, is also indicted for economic crimes. So this is the dilemma that Liberia is faced with. I mean, it is likely that the justice minister, who has some integrity issues, will also be confirmed by the Senate committee chair on judiciary, who also has some integrity issues.
There's an issue of women representation in the cabinet. It's only one woman who has been appointed, despite the fact that the president has Jewel Howard Taylor as his vice president. Why is this criticism coming so fast? I understand that he has also appointed several women to deputy ministerial position.
President Weah is on record for saying that he would ensure 50% women's participation in government. So the women want to be at the front seat too. You know, we just had a female president who had some women in ministerial positions, I mean, being the minister proper. So for President Weah not to have, at this time, made any female appointment to minister proper is raising some concerns amongst the women, especially so when he has said that he will be a he for she and he would ensure that his government will entail about 50% women.
The issue of Zoga Wilson, the new youth minister who is a former goalkeeper of the national team and local club Mighty Barol, was added. Some are saying that is welcomed because he sacrificed a lot for the country. Of course, he played alongside President Weah when they both played for the national team. What are you hearing about this?
Well, I mean, I've listened to sports journalists and they have welcomed that. Mr. Zoga Wilson is one of the few football players that played with President Weah that supported him. A lot of them didn't support him. Even the current coach of the Liberia national football team, he and the president played together, but he did not support the president during the campaign. So Zoga Wilson's appointment has been welcomed by the sports community. They believe that this is an opportunity to develop football in Liberia because Liberia hasn't been performing very well in football over the years. And many say that now that we have a soccer president, I mean, he's going to make sure that he improves the national team and the sports in general in the country.
Leonard Dodu is the Front Page African newspaper news desk chief. He spoke with me from Monrovia. The presidential candidate for the Sierra Leonean Opposition National Grand Coalition says he is ready for the official campaign period to begin in February ahead of the March 7 general election. Dr. Kandi Yomkela has recently come under criticism from supporters of the ruling party for violating the constitution. They accuse him of being an American citizen who should be barred from participating in the presidential poll. The accusation came after Dr. Yomkela officially filed nomination papers at the offices of the National Electoral Commission to represent the National Grand Coalition at the upcoming election. To learn more about his readiness for the polls, I reached presidential candidate Dr. Kandi Yomkela in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Yes, my party, the National Grand Coalition, is fully ready for the launch of the campaign. I, as an individual, as a presidential candidate, am fully ready. In fact, I have been exercising a lot to make sure that I build up my stamina and my dynamism to face the heavy campaign. So we accept. Also, thirdly, we're very confident that the people are ready. We have the youth on our side. We have the college students on our side. And a lot of the older folks who are demanding change of their situation and the revival of our economy. So I think, by and large, we in the National Grand Coalition and our supporters are fully ready to face the campaign.
What are your prospects of winning power from the APC, knowing that the party has the power of incumbency and the various instruments of the government?
Our chances are extremely good for a number of reasons. Number one, we see a wave across West Africa where the citizens are demanding change of government after 10 years. We have seen it in Cote d'Ivoire. We have seen it in Ghana, in Gambia. We have seen some of it in Nigeria itself. So we believe that wave will come to Sierra Leone. We saw it in Senegal as well. So West Africa region, we see this desire for change. Number two, 58% of our voters, about 1.8 million of them, are between the age of 17 and 35. With 70% youth unemployment, the highest in Africa, with college students graduating and still after 3 years, no job, with the blatant corruption people see around them every day, they really want change. And I have seen that as I moved around the country over time. But apart from that, we will have people power on our side. We have already seen yesterday when the ruling party did their nomination, they paid people to go around the city to scare them. People were stabbed and so on. Every other party has had nomination all week. No violence. The ruling party brought civil war to that country. We have seen them go back to history, deploying the same tactics they did in the 70s to hold on to power for almost 25 years and brought civil war. And we know that today our people do not want a repeat of that. They resent a one-party state. They have seen how power has corrupted the leadership of the APC. And I tell you, people power, we are mobilizing it big time. They will come out in numbers, a real revolution to change their situation and sue for a new path to growth, development and prosperity.
Recently, there were reports of people challenging your candidacy, saying you are a dual citizen and that you are disqualified under the prevailing constitution to stand as presidential candidate. You were cleared to stand as a member of parliament in one part of the country. However, the guys who sued you say they are going to the capital, Freetown, to launch another challenge to your candidacy. Do you think you can withstand the onslaught by some of your opponents to disqualify you from participating in the March 7 presidential election?
Indeed, I like your characterization. It was meant to be a distraction, but it is not, because we have a formidable team and machine. My legal team got into action. But I'm very happy that, in fact, the lower level returning officer already saw the hypocrisy and discriminatory nature of what the APC party is doing. All the APC did in this failed attempt to disqualify me was to confirm what we've known for 2 years, that I am the one presidential candidate they fear like hell. And so, but the hypocrisy of Mr. President, and I direct this to him, this is a man who campaigned heavily with the diaspora. They financed him back in 2005, 2006. About 30 to 40% of his cabinet were dual nationals. He even has six of them serving now as dual nationals. Total hypocrisy. This man intends to divide that nation. It is exactly what they did in the 70s that brought the civil war. He has only been able to hold on to power by dividing people. This was his last play. A play that would have disenfranchised over 100,000 diasporans and their descendants. He would use you and he would dump you. But the worst thing is he's using our nation, enriching himself and his cabal, dividing our nation so after he leaves, there's trouble in that country. But my brother, he failed already. We're ready to go all the way with him, but he also has to explain. His own candidate is a dual national. In my case, I renounce the American citizenship. The 70% of our population that is living below $2.25 a day, the 70% of our youth that are unemployed, I'm not interested in power. I'm interested in transforming the lives of Sierra Leone, the 7 million of them. But yes, he'll keep dividing that nation till the end. But he has to understand that the people are not fools anymore. They will hold him to account, even for this last-minute treachery that he did to his own party. And they're very angry with him within his party. All of this is play at State House to see if Mr. President can have a third term, create chaos, create a distraction. But he thought we would go out on the street. We did not. We relied on the legal process, and we should know that I have lined up a lot of good lawyers, including some of the former authors of the Constitution, because they're all just appalled at this hypocrisy and an attempt to disenfranchise over 100,000 Sierra Leoneans who send all over $200 million back home to keep that economy running. This is just a sinking ship, and they're just trying to catch at any straw they see. But hey, thank God, the National Electoral Commission itself is ready to resist this kleptocracy, the kind of which we've never seen in our country's history.
Dr. Kande Yomkela is presidential candidate for the Sierra Leonean Opposition National Grand Coalition. He spoke with me from Abuja. To mark World Leprosy Day, the World Health Organization is calling for the eradication of this ancient disfiguring disease by combating the stigma and discrimination that discourages people from seeking the help they need. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Leprosy, a hideously disfiguring disease that has blighted the lives of countless millions since biblical days, is curable. And yet the World Health Organization reports more than 200,000 people, most in Southeast Asia, are affected with the disease, and new cases continue to arise every year. Leprosy is a chronic bacterial disease with a slow incubation period of about 5 years. In some cases, symptoms may occur within 1 year, but can take as long as 20 years to appear. Leprosy was eliminated globally as a public health problem in 2000, but the disease persists in individuals and communities. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich tells VOA this is unacceptable, as an effective treatment exists that can fully cure people of leprosy.
Since 1995, WHO has provided this multi-drug therapy free of cost to all leprosy patients in the world. In 2016, WHO launched Global Leprosy Strategy 2016-2020, accelerating toward a leprosy-free world. And this is basically to revamp the efforts for leprosy control. The strategy focuses on avoiding disabilities, especially among children.
This year's World Leprosy Day focuses on preventing disabilities in children. WHO reports children account for nearly 9% of all new cases of leprosy, including almost 7% of those with visible deformities. The UN Health Agency notes early diagnosis and early treatment can prevent disability. It says disabilities do not occur overnight, but happen after a prolonged period of undiagnosed and untreated disease. Unfortunately, it notes many people do not seek help until it is too late, and deformities already have appeared. This is because of the stigma and discrimination associated with leprosy. WHO is calling for laws discriminating against people with leprosy to be abolished and replaced with policies promoting inclusion of such people within society. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And a second group of refugees to be resettled in the United States from Australia's offshore immigration centers has left Papua New Guinea. Washington has agreed to take up to 1,250 migrants held in Australian-run processing camps in the South Pacific. In return, Canberra will accept a small number of Central American refugees. For VOA, Field Messer has more from Sydney.
On Tuesday, 58 refugees flew out of Papua New Guinea. Most have been held at the Australian-run detention camp on Manus Island for more than 4 years. The migrants, mostly from Afghanistan and Pakistan, had been told they'd never be allowed to settle in Australia, part of Canberra's long-running policy to combat human trafficking. Last year, 54 refugees from Australia's two offshore immigration facilities on Manus Island and the tiny Pacific Republic of Nauru were resettled in the US. Another group of 130 refugees on Nauru is expected to leave the island for the US in the coming weeks. The resettlement deal was brokered between Australia and the Obama administration in 2016. And although derided as dumb by US President Donald Trump, it's seen several hundred refugees fly to the United States. In return, Australia will offer a home to a small number of Central American migrants from US-run camps in Costa Rica. So far, about 30 people have reportedly moved to Australia. Canberra recently rejected an offer made by New Zealand to take 150 of the men being held in Papua New Guinea. About 2,000 refugees and asylum seekers remain in Australia's offshore system, including several hundred men who are living in community housing on Manus Island after the Australian camp was officially closed last October. One of them is Abdul Aziz Mohammed, a refugee from Sudan.
This morning we had 58 of our friends, our close friends, that we have spent so much time with them. And this morning they were so lucky that they got on the planes and they are leaving to US. And the main question that now we have, why only the government want us to go to United States and not New Zealand's? Because the New Zealand's offer is still there on the table. Why can't the government accept the New Zealand offer to facilitate for all of us?
Australia's refugee quota has remained steady over the past two decades, with about 13,000 people accepted each year. Since 2013, asylum seekers intercepted trying to reach Australia by boat have been sent to migrant camps in the South Pacific. Officials say the policy is meant to deter others from making the same perilous sea crossing, often from Indonesia, where hundreds of people are thought to have drowned over the years. Critics, though, say Australia's offshore processing program is overly punitive and that detaining asylum seekers indefinitely has caused great psychological damage. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is The Voice of America and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin in Marrakech, Morocco, where Sudan beat Zambia 1-0 in the quarterfinals of the African Nations Champions, CHAN. In the semifinals of the tournament for locally based players only, Sudan will play the winner of Nigeria and Angola, who play in their quarterfinals in Tangier on Sunday. Meanwhile, host Morocco beat Namibia 2-0 in Casablanca, secure their place in the semifinals. The Moroccans now play Congo-Brazzaville or Libya in the semifinals. The quarterfinal match between Congo and Libya is also on Sunday in Agadir. Still in African football, Tunisia will play friendly internationals against Iran, Costa Rica and Spain as preparation for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. They will face hosts Iran on March 23rd, Costa Rica in France 4 days later, before playing Spain in the Russian city of Krasnodar on June 9. Campaigners at three successive FIFA World Cup between 1998 and 2006, the 2004 African champions missed the tournament in South Africa in 2010 and Brazil 2014. Tunisia topped a tricky qualifying group containing DR Congo, Guinea and Libya to make it to Russia 2018. On to athletics, it's been confirmed that Ethiopia's Kenenisha Bekele and Britain's Mo Farah will race in the London Marathon in April. Bekele is a triple Olympic champion on track and was second behind Kenya's Daniel Wanjiru in last year's race. Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge, the reigning Olympic marathon champion who won the event in 2015 and 2016, will also be competing in London. Bekele, Farah and Kipchoge have won a combined 8 Olympic gold medals and 12 World Championship gold medals. The three are meeting for the first time over a marathon distance. And in boxing, Saturday night in Las Vegas, Sharif Bogere put on an outstanding performance against Arturo Reyes. Reyes was badly outclassed but was able to make it to the final bell. Bogere, who has a record of 31 wins with only one loss, was too fast and strong for Reyes, who was severely outpowered. Bogere hopes to secure a title shot in the lightweight division soon. Local favorite Cameron Kral delighted his hometown fans with a unanimous decision victory over Gaku Takahashi in an exciting welterweight slugfest. Finally, in tennis, Denmark's Caroline Wozniacki beat Romanian Simone Halep to win her first Grand Slam title and regain the number one ranking at the Australian Open. The second seed won 7-6, 3-6, 6-4 in punishing conditions to finally land a major title at the 43rd attempt. The victory means the 27-year-old will replace Halep as number one in the world rankings on Monday. Twice a runner-up at the U.S. Open, Wozniak becomes the first Dane to win the Grand Slam singles title. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Anytime that you're feeling down, mama say, girl, make you settle down. Tell her, say, I don't get you down. Put the smile, make you know the frown. Say, no one can pull you down. So me sing, say, win, win, win. Win, win, win. Be good, eh? Win, win, win. You don't like nothing, no. Win, win, win. Win, win, win. Win, win, win. You don't like nothing, no. That's why I love you, my baby. I love you, my baby. Love you, my baby. I love you, Dio. I love you, my baby. Love you, my baby. I love you, my baby. I love you, Dio. What can I say, partner? Shibudi, shibudi. Juni taga bebe utam tam shoy naga doze babu yuma shaka mtimbeze zaga zigi zigi oje mtoto na mabigi biki oje kitanda nini kwichi kwichi oje asa tuki jigi chiki oh no she de make me losing control.
Mansions and property, where your baby stand properly. They must play this one for every party. You. Them they talk say I no go school. Them they talk say I they follow you. Some people say I they bobo you, but you love the way I combo you. Oh. Win win win, win win win, be good day. Win win win, if I no like now then.
Chagri abdam krashara, fenegeki bolii. Hommage à tout seul qui, à la première heure, inclut en ce mouvement. Le Zouglou, Georges Aboquet, Claude Tamo et tous ceux qui ont apporté leur soutien à notre mouvement. Grâce à vous aujourd'hui, Ivy.
Parti d'Abidjan, on est venu à Paris, oh, dans le but de travailler.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa.
The African Union is currently staging its 30th regular session at its headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. President Paul Kagame of Rwanda has already taken over the baton from President Alpha Condé as the new chairman of the African Union. President Kagame has an ambitious agenda for the reform of the African Union, and one of them is very significant. He is trying to win over the African Union from this disease of dependency. Currently, the donors support 73% of the African Union budget. Many believe this is demeaning and unacceptable. And to tackle this serious problem, President Kagame has proposed that the budget should be strengthened by minimum custom level levy of the member countries to the tune of about roughly $1.7 billion annually. Unfortunately, some of the major members of the organization are pushing back at this proposal. And another surprise is that the United States has objected to this proposal on the grounds that they contradict some of the rules of the World Trade Organization. Whatever the debate is, it must be recognized by all the members of the organization that too much dependency is not an healthy thing. And we have already begun to see the consequences of too much dependency. The Trump administration in the United States has taken off the gloves and have been giving the warning to those countries that depend too much on the largesse of donors. When a number of African states join others to oppose President Donald Trump's decision on Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, his ambassador of the United Nations, Ambassador Hillary, said clearly that there will be consequences and that those who voted against the United States will lose financial support. Just last week, another aspect was shown when President Trump himself told the Palestinians that because they have shown disrespect to the Vice President of the United States by refusing to meet with him because of the Jerusalem issue, the United States has already decided to cut off funds to the Palestinians. So this is what Africans should bear in mind, that unless they deal with the issue of self-financing of the organization, there could be grave consequences not only to the organization but to their individual countries. So hopefully those now resisting the proposal may have to rethink their position. President Kagame also has a plan to look at some of the disputes on the African continent and to see how best the African Union can be of assistance. Thus far, the African Union has not shown much results, even though when the African organization was first established in terms of the OAU, the idea was for Africans to solve African problems. Today, most of the solutions of African problems are coming from outside. Now the African Union will have to take a look at what is going on in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. For 2 years now, President Joseph Kabila has been manipulating the system to prolong his rule beyond 2016, which is the constitutional time for him to leave office, and he is even contemplating continuing. Will this be without any kind of concern by the organization? I think the summit should look at this issue. Similarly, the OAU has not done much concrete in trying to resolve the mayhem in South Sudan, nor has the OAU done much in dealing with the problem of Libya. President Kagame also wants to deal with the issue of corruption. But this is an old-age problem in Africa, and one does not see what much that could be done to deal with the issue of corruption. There is also the issue of what was reported at Davos. It was reported that three new African leaders from Angola, Zimbabwe, and South Africa have been trying to encourage investors at the World Economic Forum to come to their country. It's very well and good, but there could be a downside, a slippery slope, and it will be prudent for these countries to study carefully the controversy that raged between the late Prime Minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, and the billionaire financier, George Soros. There's much lesson to be learned as to why it is better to balance investing in your country. By and large, whatever the EU decides by tomorrow, Monday, when it ends, it should know that its decision will be able to portray Africa to the world in a way that is befitting the continent, particularly at this time, the dignity of the African continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Wojciech Zoniak, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a spider's cobweb isn't only its sleeping spring, but also its food trap. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Late on the evening of January 20th, several well-dressed men finished their dinner in the restaurant of the Kabul Intercontinental Hotel, got up from their chairs, took out assault rifles, and started shooting people. They then charged through the hotel's corridors, specifically looking to kill foreigners and officials of the Afghan government. The siege finally ended some 17 hours later, when Afghanistan security forces, with support from Norwegian troops, killed the six terrorists. By that time, at least 22 people had been murdered by the attackers. The victims came from many countries: Ukraine, South Africa, Germany, Greece, Kazakhstan, Venezuela, the United States, and, of course, Afghanistan. This attack is part of a now familiar pattern. Over the past several months, the Taliban have been attacking cafes, hotels, and restaurants, anywhere that Afghan citizens could meet and speak with foreign visitors. The Taliban are focused on isolating Afghanistan and its citizenry from the rest of the global community, using egregious violence in an attempt to impose on them their twisted ideology. The Taliban deny the people of Afghanistan a life of peace and the opportunity to build a better community, a more comfortable life. The United States strongly condemns the attack at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in a written statement. We mourn all those who lost their lives in the attack, whether Afghans or citizens of other countries. We offer our deepest condolences to the families and friends of those who were killed and wish for the speedy recovery of those wounded. The United States applauds the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces for their bravery in responding to the attack. We are in contact with Afghan authorities regarding their investigation of the incident. We have seen the Taliban's claim of responsibility and condemn terrorist groups for their violent campaign against Afghan and foreign personnel working to improve Afghanistan, said Secretary Tillerson. The United States stands with the government and people of Afghanistan. We remain firmly committed to supporting Afghan efforts to achieve peace, security, and prosperity for their country. Violence like what we witnessed in Kabul has no place in Afghanistan or anywhere else in the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.